government. Do I need to do, does the senator need to do that for his own committee? Okay, then in that case, we are underway in public hearing, and the next item on the agenda is an update on the small woodland taxation, going from bond to timber tax. I tell you, it's getting more exciting as we go down the agenda. Dick, would you please give us the overview on the, what we're about to hear from the partisans?
Basically, we started in 99 with a revision of 1990, actually, but I won't go back that far.
Yeah.
With a revision to the tax structure, which pretty much unified it in terms of moving, getting rid of the privilege taxes on which apply at the time of harvest, and making or putting all forest land values on at 100% of the values that they would have under Measure 50. So you go back again to 95 values and take 90% of those and bring them forward at 6% per year, so that they'll be, forest land will be treated just like any other property, essentially, in terms of the property tax structure. The privilege taxes go away, and as a part of this process, during the last interim, there was a group identified to asked the question of whether or not there needed to be a special tax structure for small woodlot owners. They did not arrive at a consensus in time for the last legislative session, and so you sort of asked them to take a second shot at it, to go out again. As it stands right now under current law, in 2003, the 99 program will be completely phased in and apply equally to all forest land. And so the question is whether or not you want some special treatment for small woodlot owners, and that's the question that's before them.
Okay. And to report on the progress of the work group, we have Wally Rutledge and Christina. Are you coming up too? Christina McNitt.
Good afternoon, Representative Shetterly and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Christina McNitt, and I'm representing the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. I'd like to thank you for this opportunity truly to testify this afternoon and give you an update of what we're doing on this second and final tax task force to come up
one way or another, it's the final
small woodland owners. Mr. Yates gave a good background briefing, actually, of the question posed before us. You may be wondering why there's a need to find some sort of alternative for the small woodland owner. And I would just suggest to you that they face some unique challenges in the fact that a lot of them have smaller acreages. They don't manage their timber daily for the purpose of deriving income. And so to meet an annual income property tax obligation would be more difficult than if they had a revenue stream that was derived annually. Prior to passage of House Bill 3575, which was the bill Mr. Yates referred to, forest land property taxes were paid in the form of a privilege tax, where 20% was paid annually and 80% was paid at the time of harvest, again, when you had cash. Beginning in 2003, all forest land owners are going to pay their property taxes 100% every year, unless we come up with an alternative. This task force that was asked to come up with an alternative during the last legislative session kind of got stuck after 18 months of hard work, mostly because they were following, I think, an interpretation of their own interpretation of the legislative directive to come up with an alternative. And now that there's been a task force generously supported by this committee and the Senate Revenue Committee, I think they have a broader perspective of what some of their potentials might be in looking at a new program. Today, the Department of Forestry has completed selecting a mix of 11 people to serve on this new task force. Additionally, the department has retained the professional services of two excellent and experienced facilitators. The department has included two CPAs as technical advisors, and has secured the commitment of former Linn County Commissioner Dave Schmidt to serve as the acting chair of the task force. The group has held its first meeting in Salem on November 6th. It worked through an agenda that included the development of a committee charter, where participants on the work group contributed to a group understanding of their charge. They have a group understanding, and they're working on their background assumptions, their guiding principles, and their working guidelines. The history and the background of timber taxation was introduced at this meeting, and participants began to build the necessary relationships to support effective group outcomes. A year-long work plan and calendar were also scheduled at that meeting. Representative Susan Morgan came as a guest to the first meeting and challenged the group to be cohesive and productive, and she clearly spelled out the expectation that some legislative proposal will be developed for consideration in early 2003. And I believe that this close attention and the support of legislative leadership, including this committee and Representative Morgan, Senator Meserle, and some others, has greatly facilitated this effort and made the people participating in the work group recognize how important an outcome truly is. I'm going to shift to Wally Rutledge here from the department, and he can speak more specifically to the charter and some of the outcomes at the first meeting.
Hey, thank you, Christina. For the record, my name is Wally Rutledge. I'm the Director of Forestry Assistance with the Department of Forestry. And I guess I've been given the charge of getting this committee together and hopefully coming back with some substantive legislation that you can deal with in the next session. Christina has given you some background. I have handed out to you a copy of the draft charter that we're working on. And I'll just briefly touch a little bit on that. I think it's very important as we start the group that we all have a good understanding of what we are supposed to be doing. And so this is a draft that we worked on at the first meeting that was held November the 6th. This is sort of an updated version of that draft that will go back to the next meeting, which is December the 19th, and hopefully will be accepted by the group. It starts out with a little bit of the background and the purpose of the group. It goes into some assumptions that we're making in terms of what the importance of non-industrial private forest landowners and the family forest landowners are to the state of Oregon and how they manage their lands. And I won't go through that. We've already heard a little bit about how they're managed differently than the industry. And I think there's no disagreement with that. Most of them, in fact, do manage quite a bit differently. And a lot of them do not have an annual income, which makes them much different than the industry. So we've got those assumptions that we're working on, and we've got some guiding principles that we've developed. And some of these guiding principles actually come right out of the current statutes, and so we're including those in as guiding principles as we work through a new tax option for the small woodland owners. Then there's a charge for the committee, and basically most of that charge comes right out of House Bill 2162, which was passed by the legislature and signed by the governor during the last session. Part of that charge is to develop some options and then come back to the Legislative Assembly in 2003. You also have the members on there. Christina mentioned that we did get Dave Schmidt to chair the committee. He is a former Linn County Commissioner and a small woodland owner. We have a couple of Eastern Oregon forest family landowners on there, two from Southwestern Oregon and two from Northwest Oregon. And then we have two members of the county assessors, Paul Chalmers from Eastern Oregon, actually is the chair of the Association of County Assessors. Tim Lutz from Tillamook County is the incoming chair of the association, and so we think that we're tied in very good with the assessors as we move through this process. Then Sarah Vickerman from the Conservation Community Defenders of Wildlife is part of that committee. And then Norm Miller from the Department of Revenue and myself representing the Department of Forestry. One of the key things I think that is going to help us is that we do have some facilitators that Christina mentioned. Connie Green and Vicki Willis work out of Chemeketa Community College, and we've used them before on some committees such as the FPAC committee. They've done a very good job for us in the past. And at our first meeting, they kept us on track and were very helpful in helping us with that meeting. We do have a time frame that we're working on. We hope to complete our task by September of next year, which will give us then time to make sure that we have good support for the recommendations that we make, and then come back to the legislature early in 2003, hopefully right after session opens. As soon as you're willing to hear what we have to report, we'll be ready to come and report, we hope. The timing is critical because if we don't get something passed early on, then these small woodland owners will be taxed as the large industry starting July 1st, 2003. So I think that's basically we got a good group. We got a lot of enthusiasm. At our first meeting, we had several, somewhere in the neighborhood, I didn't count exactly, 7 or 8 or 10 small woodland owners that were sitting in the audience that were interested in what we're doing. I recently attended a meeting of an advisory committee of small woodland owners in Northeast Oregon, and there was about 30 people there. We talked about this tax group, and I believe about 20 of them signed up to be on the mailing list, so that we're going to keep them informed all the way along. And so the small woodland owner and Oswald has agreed to keep their membership really informed as we move along. So as we develop some options and so forth, they'll be able to give us their input right as we go along and not wait until the end when we try and come forward with something. So with that, I think that's a pretty good update on where we are, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Are there questions?
Mr. Chair, I didn't follow this very closely during session, and I just, maybe you can help me fill in some blanks. This looks on paper like an unusual working group. We've brought in facilitators, and the first two meetings are spent putting together a charter, and this is a group that's going to have its work done by the end of next year. And I think Christina indicated that they've tried once before to do this and had failed. I don't mean to be indelicate, but are these folks who don't get along or something? I mean, the issue sort of goes on and on. It's certainly one that needs to be resolved. This just struck me as somewhat unusual.
Okay, that's a fair question. Co-Chair Chatterley and Senator Deuce. The last group that worked on this had a very narrow charge of only looking at deferred tax options. And when they got into that, they decided to need to do more than just look at the deferred option. And so they did that, but they ran out of time before they developed some concepts, but before they could put any details together, they ran out of time in order to get it before the last legislature. So that's why the extension of the group, and this is an entirely different group than the one was before. There isn't, I don't think, a whole lot of disagreement. The problem is we got so many issues because the woodland owners have so many diverse objectives and goals in the way they manage the forest that we need somebody to keep us on track as we move through all of these issues and develop options that may address the different issues that the small woodland owners have faced. We did more than just develop a charter at the first meeting. We did a lot of backgrounding on timber taxes and so forth. We started to actually look at issues. This next meeting, we're going to look at some tax programs from other states and see how they might present some opportunities or options for us to look at. Then we're going to continue to address the issues and then hopefully start to develop some options that will address those issues at the next meeting in December. And we are really pretty optimistic that we can get something together by early September next year.
Great. Do you anticipate monthly meetings? Is that
Co-Chair Chatterley? Yes, there will be almost monthly meetings, okay. At least every 4 to 6 weeks.
Who knows? Maybe this will become the protocol of choice for work groups to establish a charter so they keep track of what they're supposed to be doing and talking about. Whatever works, we hope it does. Any other questions? Representative Hayden.
Well, at least hopefully you would get close enough that we can pre-session file something and then the legislative committees can do their magic with that.
Yes, Co-Chair Chatterley, Representative Hayden, that's our plan is to get it pre-filed prior to session.
Christine, I appreciate your comment about legislative interest in this, and that was one of our purposes, too, of putting you on early in the interim as opposed to late in the interim so that you knew that we were interested in seeing this through to a conclusion as well. So I hope you'll convey that back to the work group, too. This is important to us to see this get done successfully.
Chairman Shetterly, I really couldn't emphasize that too much. It gives me a tool to use when I write in the Update magazine to the small woodland owners across the state and to speak about when I go out to their county chapter meetings. This is by far our top number one issue, and I've told them again and again that our product is only going to be as good as the input we receive. And it really made quite an impression on some people when Representative Morgan came and spoke to them. They were very impressed, and I think the seriousness of their task was apparent to them at that point.
Good. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is that all we have on this? Okay. That will conclude this portion of the agenda. We will move then to Oregon's inheritance. Ed, are you going to give us the background on that, and then let's go ahead and invite up, what we got, Ron, and who else?
Well, I'm not going to.
Come on up to the table here.
That's the way you're supposed to do it.
Debra.
I think it's right there. Yeah, I have a good one. I love it.
Ed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, chairs, members of the committee. I've distributed a handout, which is a report of a two-page report on the Oregon Inheritance Tax, giving you some background and history. There's also an attachment to it which shows what Oregon, as well as other states, are currently doing in very general terms. Regarding a pickup tax and whether or not they have their own state death tax. But by way of a general overview, Oregon taxpayers do not currently pay a state or inheritance taxes to Oregon in addition to their federal estate tax liability. Rather, Oregon, like all other states, uses the federal state death tax credit as a pickup tax, collecting the maximum amount allowed under federal law as a credit against the federal estate tax. No more. A pickup tax applies when the state-imposed death tax liability is less than the maximum state death tax credit. Pickup tax does not affect the taxpayer's total, that is, federal plus state tax liability, but provides the state with the maximum amount of tax revenue allowable as a state death tax credit. By way of a little history, Oregon levied its own distinct statutory inheritance tax until 1987. Prior to 1978, that tax varied with the amount of the inheritance and the relationship of the beneficiary to the decedent. If the amount of the Oregon tax was less than the maximum state death tax credit allowed by federal law, then the difference was also collected as a pickup tax. The 1997 legislature enacted simplification and a gradual repeal of the Oregon inheritance tax system. And beginning January 1, 1987, under that legislation, the inheritance tax rate became zero, and the system reverted to its current form with only the pickup tax remaining. Regarding Oregon inheritance tax in connection to federal law, as you know, the Economic Growth and Tax Relief Reconciliation Act of 2001, Public Law 107-16, among other things, reduces the federal estate tax over a nine-year period. The federal estate tax was completely repealed in 2010. However, under that bill, it's reversed back to its current form in 2011, which will be very interesting to see.
I hope I do.
No.
Did you see it?
Being the oldest person here, you know, I have more at stake.
You live to regret it.
PL 107-16 also phases out the state death tax credit between 2002 and 2005. This is to help mitigate some of the federal revenue impact here. Oregon does not automatically connect to changes in the federal estate tax. Oregon is currently tied to the federal state death tax credit as it was defined in 1997, which is the last time the relevant Oregon statute was modified.
Thus, Oregon inheritance taxes will not automatically decline along with the repeal of the federal estate tax. While taxpayers' federal estate tax will fall, their Oregon tax liability probably will not. This connection issue is complicated by the federal unified credit, which creates a value threshold for taxable estates. Changes in the unified credit since 1997 have gradually increased the tax threshold, thereby excluding an increasing number of individuals from having to pay the federal estate tax. If Oregon were truly frozen for the 1997 federal estate tax, then everyone liable under the 1997 definition of the unified credit should currently pay Oregon estate taxes, whether or not they had federal tax liability. However, Oregon has collected inheritance taxes only from those individuals paying the federal estate tax. By not requiring those individuals falling between the 1997 federal taxability threshold and the current threshold to file and pay Oregon estate tax, Oregon seems to have effectively connected to the changes in the federal unified credit. Well, what are the implications of all this for Oregon? Approximately $90 million, although in the current revenue forecast, I think the number was $84 million. Approximately $90 million or $84 million in Oregon inheritance tax is collected each biennium. All of this is general fund revenue. If Oregon chooses to adopt the spirit of the federal changes and phase out its inheritance tax, then general fund revenue will be reduced by about $22 million in the current biennium, 2001-03, by $66 million in 03-05, and by the full amount, about $90 million in 05-07. If Oregon chooses to enact its own inheritance tax or to hold to a prior version of the disappearing state death tax credit, then this will start costing Oregon taxpayers real dollars, not simply dollars that would have otherwise have gone to the federal government. Phase out of the federal estate tax exerts pressure on the legislature to either ratify the federal changes in PL 10716 and update Oregon's pickup tax, or else to enact a separate and distinct Oregon inheritance tax law, as was the case until 1987. And this issue obviously should be addressed by the 2003 legislature. Mr. Chair, is that all I have?
The chair moves that the committee require Ed to go make slides so we can watch this on the screen. Everybody got that all? Everybody got that?
It's all in the report.
Yeah, it's all in the report. Actually, it's very interesting. And that is a good statement of the history and of the problem. Any questions of Ed before we turn to our witnesses?
Did we get a copy of this?
Yeah, it's in the meeting packet. Okay. Then, oh, I'm sorry. Senator Dukes.
Oh, I'm stumbling through this. This applies to people who inherit more than $700,000?
Well, it's not imposed on the people who inherit, it's imposed on the estate
okay.
of the decedent.
If an estate is $700,000 or larger, and...
Well, right now, the federal exemption equivalent is $675,000. In 1997, it was $600,000. So there's the issue: whether Oregon has made a de facto connection by allowing estates to be treated as if they're still connected at that $675,000 threshold. So the death tax at the federal level applies to estates at this point with a value of over $675,000. On January 1, that'll be stepped up to $1 million, I believe.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Under the new law. January 1, 2002, that threshold goes up to $1 million, and then it increased in steps up to $3.5 million in 2009, and then
that's how they're phasing it away.
And that's an accelerated increase in the threshold over what was in prior law. Prior law also has a gradual increase in that threshold,
but not an increase to elimination.
Not an increase to elimination.
Okay, who wants to go first? We have Doug Henney from the CPAs, Ron Bailey from the Bar Tax, Estate Planning or Tax? Oh, I forget.
Estate Planning.
Estate Planning, thank you. And Deborah from the Department. Who wants to go first? Ron. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name's Ron Bailey. I'm an attorney practicing in Portland in the area of estate planning and tax, and I'm chair-elect of the Estate Planning Committee of the Oregon State Bar. And we really do appreciate this opportunity to be here and also would like to participate in any legislation or considerations regarding the inheritance tax that take place in the next couple of years. Most of my presentation was just well done by staff here, but I will...
It bears repeating. Don't be shy.
I'll hit a few highlights. First of all, you know the federal act is the Economic Growth and Tax Relief Reconciliation Act. If you don't mind, I'd like to refer to it as EGTRA. So if I use the word EGTRA, I'm referring to the new federal law. The other point is that there is a technical difference between estate taxes and inheritance taxes. I don't think it makes any difference for our discussion here today, but technically an estate tax is a tax on the right to transfer property. It's a tax on the estate. A true inheritance tax is a tax on the right to receive property, to inherit property. We call our state tax an inheritance tax, but at this stage it's really closer to an estate tax. So today you may hear the words inheritance tax and the estate tax used interchangeably, and I think it's fine for this discussion. Now, what EGTRA did was to repeal over a period of time the federal estate tax. This new law starts in next year, 2002, and it phases out gradually the amount that one would have to pay tax on until the year 2010, at which time there's a complete repeal. But the law is then sunsetted so that in year 2011, the law as we know it today comes back into effect. If you have my testimony, there is a chart there that I think helps illustrate what takes place. So next year, we're going to have an amount exempt from federal tax that that will be $1 million. Now, this federal tax, ERGTA, also does one other thing, and that's a couple of other things. It reduces rates over a period of time. This year, the maximum federal estate tax rates are 55%. Next year, they'll be 50, and they'll decrease 1% a year until 2010. The other thing it does is reduce down to a repeal of the state death tax credit. And maybe it would be helpful if I spent just a little time on this state death tax credit and what it is. The federal government has always allowed states to share, if you will, in a portion of the estate tax. They do this by allowing a credit. If a state pays inheritance taxes, the federal government says those taxes can be taken as a credit against the federal tax up to a limit, and the federal government establishes that limit. So most states do not impose an independent inheritance tax, but impose a tax that they call a pickup tax or a sponge tax. The state says, in effect, we will just pick up the amount that's allowed for the state credit on the federal return. If the state didn't pick that up, it would go to the federal government anyway. So all the federal government is doing is allowing the state to share in a portion of that tax. This state death tax credit is now being phased out. Next year, states will only get 75% of that amount. The following year, 50%, the following year, 25%, and in 2005, it will be phased out altogether. Notice that the state death tax credit is phased out much faster than the estate tax. So the federal government in these early years is getting a little more revenue, presumably just to help the phase in of the federal estate tax, to the detriment of the states. Now, most states have one of three types of taxes. A very few states have a true independent, this inheritance tax that they impose. Most states have the pickup tax. There's two types of pickup taxes. One is the type that says, state, we will pick up what is allowed by the federal government based on the federal law then in effect. Other states, including Oregon, have a tax that says, we will pick up the, or accept the pickup tax based on the federal law in effect as of a given date. And the given date for Oregon to tie into the federal law is 1997. The reason for this is that our inheritance tax law tied into federal law was last amended in 1997. So the law refers then to the 1997 federal law. So the effect of ERGTA it is minimal or zero to Oregon. Now, I understand there's a little difference between, or maybe Revenue Department and the AG's office is not completely eye to eye on some of this, but the Attorney General just this week on Monday issued an opinion to the effect that we tie into the 1997 federal law. So the effect of that is we will pick up the same amount of tax that was allowed under the prior law. So whereas the federal government is phasing out the state death tax credit, it's not going to affect what Oregon imposes.
Well, effectively, then people will be, at some point, on that scenario, will be paying more in Oregon tax than they will be entitled to claim as credit against the federal estate tax.
Correct.
That's where we're going.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay.
Let me give an example of what I think is going to happen in next year, 2002. Now, revenue may have a little different take on it, but I'm basing this on the Attorney General's opinion that came out this week. In 2002, the old federal law would have had an exemption of $700,000. So we tie into that so that the amount that will be exempt from federal, or from, excuse me, state inheritance tax next year will be $700,000. The federal exemption will be $1 million based on the new law. So Oregon will be imposing a tax on the difference between $700,000 and $1 million. Now, the old law phased in an exemption. It'll be $700,000 next year. It moves up gradually to $1 million. But the federal law, as we all know, will be phased up higher. It will step in a couple of years to $1.5 million, and then $2 million, and $3.5 million, and then it's repealed. So Oregon is really now imposing a direct tax, whereas before we were just sharing federal revenue with the feds. We're now going to be imposing a direct tax. So that's a consideration.
For clarification, that's not on account of anything we've done. That's on account of the changes at the federal level.
No, that's because
we haven't
our law is frozen to an old law, to an old federal law.
Yeah, mm-hmm. They changed the rules.
The feds changed the rules, but it doesn't affect us because we were tied to the law that was in effect in 1990. We are tied to the law that's in effect in 1997. So that's essentially where we are. Oregon is now going to have a tax on the states that will directly affect its residents who pass away, or the estates of residents who pass away. And the federal law, or ATRA, is not going to affect it much. Now, some general thoughts in this area. We're talking really about a tax on the wealthy. Nationally, less than 2% of the population that passes away has to worry about these death taxes, inheritance or estate taxes. And according to an Oregonian article in 1997, we had 28,750 deaths, but only 421 paid any death taxes to Oregon. So we're talking, I think in Oregon, that figure is probably less than 2%, the people who are really even concerned with this issue. But we are now going into a phase that will cost Oregon residents real dollars. They won't be able to take it as a credit against any federal estate tax. It's going to mean more compliance problems. Revenue, I'm sure, can talk on that issue and what they're going to have to do with that. Because essentially, they, in the past, they tied in to the federal government. And if an estate had to file a federal estate tax, it also had to file an Oregon tax, but Oregon's tax was just a one-page sheet. And essentially, it was, send in a copy of the federal return, give us our state death tax credit, and that's it. And then a receipt would be issued by the state. The state will have to do more now, and they'll really have to deal, I think, with this issue of if there's going to be this tax between $700,000 and $1 million next year. Representative Shetterly asked me to comment a little on what compliance problems I see with tax practitioners and estate planning practitioners out here. I really don't see too much of a problem. I think Mr. Henning can talk on this better than I, but I don't see a big problem, compliance problem, out in the public. We lawyers and attorneys that do this type of work, we lawyers and CPAs that do this type of work, will probably have to file a separate return now with Oregon, whereas we didn't have to do that before. But I don't view that as a major issue. Clients will have to pay for it. It's a little additional client expense, of course. But another issue is, what happens if we do continue to impose this tax, it becomes a direct tax? It's likely that our wealthy residents will look to those states that aren't imposing a direct tax and consider moving there. And we've seen this in Portland area especially. We've seen a lot of people moving across the river to Vancouver, the wealthy. And so if our inheritance tax becomes a burden and becomes more of a tax than one would have to pay in another state, we're likely to see this trend of moving out of Oregon continue as to wealthy residents. So if I, as an estate planner, have a client come in and ask, as they often do, how can I save death taxes? You know, my advice would likely be, if Oregon's inheritance taxes are higher than another state, we'll move to the other state. So these are some considerations we'd want to throw out today, and I'll let the rest of them correct me and add to my comments.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Mr. Bailey? All right, let's go to the CPAs. Mr. Henney.
Thank you. My name is Doug Henney. I'm a practitioner with a firm based out of Portland. I live in Portland. We have four offices throughout Oregon. I'm also on the board of the Oregon Society of CPAs. I'm going to assume you don't want to hear the same thing a third time. Okay. So maybe what I'll do is pull out from what I was planning on talking about and maybe reinforcing some points, maybe bringing up a few other thoughts that I had. Let me start out by saying that the state tax rules, and you really can't separate Oregon from federal since they're so, I mean, Oregon, like Ron said, is just a one page sheet of paper. It's a no-brainer. But the federal rules are extremely complicated. If you look at the instructions for the federal form, it says it takes 40 hours to learn the rules and fill out the form. I'm guessing that that's a very conservative estimate, and that ignores the legal and accounting fees that it takes to get the thing done. I mean, a lot of federal estate tax returns are, you know, several, 3-4 inches thick. I mean, it's a voluminous document. It takes a lot of time, and the rules are extremely complicated. I guess, again, I'll be skipping around a little bit because I'm trying to maybe get some of the highlights of some things that weren't talked about before. One of my concerns is that if Oregon keeps the same levels of that they're currently at as far as who needs to pay tax, you'll start to have more and more people who have to file a return just for Oregon. And with the extra tax they'll have to pay just to Oregon, I really am thinking that you'll see people move out of the state. You know, you're talking for estates of more than about $10 million. You're talking about a 16% tax on the value of their assets. And with a little planning, you can move real property elsewhere. With a little more planning, you can basically avoid all the tax on this Oregon inheritance tax if they were to impose one. So I'd like to reiterate what Ron said, is that it wouldn't take a whole lot of planning and a move across a river if Washington didn't have such a tax to avoid the inheritance tax.
That's a question, I guess. I was looking on the chart, and Washington imposes a pickup tax. Do you happen to know, is that one of those floating pickup taxes, or is it one, is it pegged to a particular date, and what is Washington doing about this same issue? Does anybody know? Okay.
I don't know.
All I do know is, of course, they're meeting next year. They have annual sessions, and they are addressing that. But, and my belief is that it is the floating inheritance tax too, but that's all I know.
Yes, another part of the difficulty is these federal rules were passed in a time when they thought they had a very large surplus revenues. I think as reality hit and as September 11th hit, I think there's a lot of speculation that the rules will change. They could very likely maybe increase the amount of wealth you'd have to have before a return needs to be filed or before tax needs to be paid. I'm guessing that they're not going to eliminate it, but that's just my guess. But I'm not the only one that I think is in the boat.
Is there any discussion? They talk about changing the phase out of the state death tax credit in any event? Or if you're talking about the feds maybe not phasing out the estate tax entirely, would they? Is anyone talking whether they'll? Whether
I've not heard much speculation on that.
Credit,
I think the feds kind of like that part, where
yeah.
They left Oregon and more
right.
To Washington D.C.
Yeah. Okay.
But it is a large burden to prepare these returns, to do all the filings and pay the tax, and I think part of the federal effort was to maybe. You know, it had to be larger and larger estates before the rules even applied. And with inflation, with value of homes going up, we are seeing more and more people who have to file these returns. I'm guessing that as part of Oregon separating, and maybe Deborah can answer more to this. It require a lot more auditing of the Department of Revenue. The federal auditors, it's my understanding that they're all attorneys, and they look at virtually every return that comes through, and some fairly extensively. It would be my assumption that Oregon has to do almost nothing other than file the piece of paper and cash the check. At least in the past, that's all they've really had to do. Whereas in the future, I'm sure it would take a lot more hiring or training of people, a lot more auditing. And I'm not really sure where the trade-off is, whether it makes sense in that regards, because it would require a lot more effort by a lot of people to collect and, I mean, not to collect, but actually to assess or to audit these returns. Another concern that I think maybe it's more of a CPA sort of a concern, as part of this repeal, if it really goes through, if the federal death taxes are repealed, then they'll probably get rid of the basis step up at death. You know, currently, when a person passes away, their heirs have a new basis, a new cost in those assets equal to the value when they die. And so if somebody sells those assets the next day or the next year, it's only based upon the appreciation after the date of death. And estate planners and at least accountants sort of say that in the past, you know, you paid your federal death tax, your state death tax, you got your basis step up, and so there's really no double taxation going on there. That's just kind of the price of this basis step up. If I foresee an issue that if Oregon continues to, you know, if they impose this inheritance tax, if feds do not have an inheritance tax, if the feds then eliminate the basis step up, Oregon would be somewhat, or in some minds, some people would be having a double tax on appreciation of property. Now, I certainly wouldn't want to endorse having separate cost records for Oregon. I mean, we went through that from 1981 through a couple of years ago, and that was it kept a lot of accountants busy, but that was not a lot of fun, and it was a lot of work. And eventually, I think the legislature decided that it wasn't worth the hassle, and they got rid of that.
You're saying you pay the tax, the death tax, based on the value of the asset at the day of death, and then even a sale, you'd pay tax on that gain over the original basis in the asset and not on a stepped-up basis. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And so that would obviously, if we were to do something as far as a carryover basis, or step-up for Oregon, that would obviously be a huge accounting and bookkeeping nightmare. I think that's really the only additional comments I had to make.
Okay. Questions? Deborah, what are the department's take on this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. These gentlemen have covered a lot of the points that I did want to make. I did want to say that the 87 law was enacted, I think, to simplify the estate tax process for Oregon. It is very simple. It is a matter of just picking up a number off the federal return and putting it on the Oregon form. I think that the result of this disconnect is going to put us back to a pre-87 position where we will have a separately administered estate tax for Oregon, assuming that no changes are made by the legislature. Doug and Mr. Bailey are both correct that we have relied heavily on federal expertise in administering the Oregon estate tax. Because it is so simple, it's just a number off the federal return, we have been able to rely on federal employees, essentially, to do many of the audits that are necessary. They simply report those results to us, and we make the adjustment. So that simplicity has led us maybe to not have the expertise that perhaps we should have to administer a program really well. That's not to say that we cannot get that expertise. Some of the factors that we think will ease this burden are, number one, there are very few estate returns filed for Oregon. As Mr. Bailey pointed out, in 1997, I think there were 421. When you consider that there are over 1.5 million individual returns filed with us, less than 2,000 estate returns, it's a pretty small program. And the other thing that helps ease this burden is that we have people like Mr. Bailey and Mr. Henney who are preparing these estate returns. We don't find people who will prepare their individual returns. That type of person generally is not going to come in and prepare grandma's estate return when they have a taxable estate. You have the professionals doing that. So our goal, our objective would be to communicate the status of the Oregon law to the preparers so that they know, the attorneys know, what the situation is. And then I don't believe we would have a significant compliance problem because of that difference that we talked about where they would be filing for Oregon and not for federal. I really don't think that is something that our agency is worried about as far as compliance and filing. So what we would be doing is communicating the status to the preparers. We want to work on a form that we hope will make this as simple as possible, and we've had offers from the practitioners to help us with that in developing something that would be simple to do. And then also most likely work on developing some more in-house expertise in this program to perhaps get us up a little bit more on what federal law is and what we would need to know. But I just want to emphasize that absent any change, we will be back to what we had before 97, which is administering a separate program for the estate tax in Oregon. And I'd be happy to try to answer any questions you might have.
Representative Vince. Just a quick question about the people moving. Could you clarify who exactly would be moving? Would it be grandma or the five siblings?
It would be grandma in your example. It would be the person that was ready to retire or maybe getting up in the years, and they moved to a nursing home in some state that had. I'm guessing that there'd be some states that, for lots of political reasons, would not be able to pass the tax if they're fully connected now, and it could be like the elderly that would be moving.
Could I just add to that? I would agree with that, but we find quite often the wealthy people in our state have been those that have accumulated a lot of money, that perhaps have owned their own business, been very successful. And these are the same people that pay more in income tax, more property taxes. So it would be these individuals. Yes, it'd be grandma if she had a large estate, but it would also be these elderly people who have been very successful and leaders throughout the entire process.
Same folks who take their capital gains over to Washington.
And, excuse me, maybe even more so, because the capital gain is probably part of their assets. This inheritance tax would be 16% on their entire work.
You bet.
Mr. Chairman, I have one thing. You asked a question about whether the federal phase-out was being discussed as possibly a revision to
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
When this bill was being discussed, the states did let Congress know about the revenue impact on the states, and I believe there was a change in the final bill, but this is what it ended up being, was the 25, 50, and 75. So they were aware of the problem they have caused for the states.
They did it anyway. Okay. This sort of frames the issues that our inheritance tax work group is going to have to look at, and that is basically to remain status quo with what we have, in which case then we are effectively, we've moved to a separate state death tax system again, or to connect to the federal changes in the estate tax, in which case then the state would not impose its own estate or inheritance tax, and then looking at the revenue impacts of that and the foregone taxes that the state has been collecting under the current regime. And that's basically the choices, isn't it?
Okay.
All right, good stuff. Anybody else? And you all are going to be helping on the work group, right?
Thank
you. Doug, are you on the work group? Good. Oh, you are?
I'd love to help.
Okay.
They are now.
Yeah, well, we got some technical folks. Thank you very much. Fred, did you want to come forward? Fred Van Ann asked if he could address one issue that's, I think, tangential, but still related to the state tax, maybe for the work group to take up as well. So I said, sure, as long as we're talking about that, come on up.
I am Fred Bonata, appearing here on behalf of myself. I was recently appointed the executor of an estate. The information that was just presented has a refinement in it that I didn't know about, but I still think it's worthwhile to discuss the issue because you will have some policy decisions relative to that. The phase-out of the state credit by 205 makes my original suggestion not relevant, but the issue, so you understand it, is a provision in the federal law that allows the delay for small family-owned businesses that are largely land agricultural-based enterprises.
Property-rich, cash-poor.
Absolutely. The circumstance that I am dealing with, the federal government will allow a four-year deferral and then 10 equal payments of the 75% of the tax that will be imposed on the property for which I am the executor. The state wants their 25% in cash immediately, and this is timber property, and we have ordered the chainsaws to go find the most valuable timber on the property and fall it and move it. But we are going to be unable to meet the 9-month deadline that this, that has for the payment of the tax to the state. And that is, that creates, the executor is personally liable. So that, lets me worry about the options. But the point I want to leave with you as you decide what you do about this, give some consideration if you maintain a tax separate from the federal.
Or even during the phase out.
Yeah. Well, I was going to suggest that during the phase out, you adopt this federal delayed option for folks. But the state tax credit eliminates in 05, and by the time you get it adopted, it's gone. Be aware of the federal provision that allows for a delay for your farm and timber folks. If you choose to impose a state or inheritance tax, be aware of the small, that at least at the federal level, they have recognized that it places a serious hardship on small family-owned businesses and have provided a provision for dealing with it over time. I just wanted to call that to your attention.
Okay. Ed, you got that? All right. Thank you, Fred. Any questions for Fred? All right. With that, that takes us through the inheritance tax and to the tax incidence model work plan, and Paul is not here. Can you cover that for us? Okay, please.
Mr. Chairs, members of the committees, you should have a copy of the OTIM work plan. That's the Oregon Tax Incidence Model Interim Work Plan that we put together to help guide us through the interim period. This grew out of a model, OTIM model work group meeting that was held here on October 15th. We identified a couple of objectives and some activities to help us achieve those objectives during the next year. The objectives are, one, to improve the accuracy and credibility of OTIM model, and two, to make the OTIM results more accessible to policymakers. And activities that we identified to help us in those directions were, one, to review some of the literature on model parameters, specifically the trade elasticities, export-import elasticities in the OTIM model, and to make some changes to those parameters where appropriate. There has been some work done in at the national level and international level and other states that I think we can draw from. We had thoughts that maybe the big piece, especially the literature survey, historical search of this activity could be contracted out, and probably that would be to Oregon State University through the good offices of Dr. Bruce Weber. Another activity we identified is to look at OTIM's treatment of the property tax, especially the non-residential or business property tax, and thinking about some things we could do to improve the way that is modeled so it might better represent theory about how this business property tax works in the real world, although there's still a lot of debate, I guess, and discussion about how that actually works. Again, I think a piece of this could be contracted out, and we're also starting to look at what data and what resources there are available here in-house. Another piece, this is getting more technical, but to look at some of the corporate income tax data we have incorporated in the model. There's reason to believe that the base year we used, 1997, there were a couple of problems. One is it was really kind of a peak year in terms of investment, especially in high-tech sectors. And also, I think that some of the industry classifications for some of that data were not as good as they could be. We've been working with the Department of Revenue to revise and refine that, and I think we've made a lot of progress into better breaking out how the corporate income tax is spread and paid by different kinds of industry sectors. I think a large piece of that has already been done. Along those same lines, take a look at the core industry data and the OTIM model and make adjustments where necessary or where warranted. And again, this is this 1997 base year issue. 1997 was a boom year, and that may not be as representative of current economy or the sort of equilibrium or base level Oregon economy that we'll want to model or want to use as the base for the model in the future. This is something that we'll be looking at in-house primarily. As far as getting the word out about OTIM, we've identified a need to get OTIM results and experience into the literature and reviewed and into some peer-reviewed journals so that it gets more exposure and also gets some more critique. And we'll be working with Oregon State University to move some of the work into a couple of two or three publications during the next year. Finally, we had in mind to develop an orientation package for legislators that will involve a handout report and a slideshow presentation at the beginning of each session to help legislators understand what OTIM is, how it can be used, why we use it, and give people that background, that high level sort of understanding of what we're trying to do and how this helps as a policy tool going into every legislative session. And finally, develop a better way to translate some of the myriad variable outputs that we get from each OTIM run into a template or a report that is best understandable and best usable for the purposes that we in LRO and you as decision makers would like to see. Basically, that's our OTIM work plan.
Okay.
Overview.
Yes. So
Ed, I was just wondering, since you're talking about trying to get this in publications and peer review publications, are we creating new territory here, or are we leading the way on trying to create such a model, or are we looking at other states who have already done this and we're trying to create our own version, or?
Senator Castillo, members of the committees, the model has been developed and used through one legislative session so far.
Mm-hmm.
It's drawn on a lot of the work and experience that California went through when they built their own model. There hasn't been a lot of this type of work published in academic journals or economics type journals, but we think there are a couple of openings where we can pursue that. For example, the National Tax Journal would be one forum we think we can probably target. And their weekly publication, State Tax Notes, has published briefs or short articles on dynamic revenue analysis in the past, both for the California DRAM model and some other models or projects in other states. So to answer your question, there's some path out there that we can follow, but a lot of it will be our own initiative.
Mm-hmm. Well, I got into Cat Fancy magazine this last session, so I can see if I can get there.
You got into what?
Cat Fancy.
Oh,
but part of that question too, though, was how many other states? I mean, this California has this, but we really are out in front. I mean, we've built on what California has done, but we're one of those states that's out on the edge as far as the development and now actual implementation use of this model, right?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Which is why it'd be worthwhile publishing and letting people read about it. Yeah.
That's correct. The person who was primarily responsible for the California model, I had a serious health problem last year, and I think their development of their model and maybe the future of it is a little bit in jeopardy because of that. So it may be up to us to sort of pick up the torch and help them carry that along in the future. But really, yeah, California and Oregon are the two states.
Okay. Anything else?
Peer reviewed publication.
Of Cat Fancy?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, would you call that peer review? per review. Oh.
I wasn't going to go there.
All right. Now, this does not require action. You're just presenting this to us, I assume, from the OTM work group. All right, well, I think that brings us to the close of the agenda. I do note, and Anna, maybe you can tell us why we have this, the K-12 and ESD school finance, state school fund distribution report in our packets.
I'm glad you
saw. That's just distribution because it's fresh off the press. Is that it? Okay. Okay. All right, I want to thank committee members and some of our diehards, again, staying with us to the end. A reminder that the House Revenue Committee will next meet on February 28th. And with that,
the Senate committee will reconvene in hearing room E.
Oh, you're not done.
Oh, goodness, no.
Okay.
The Senate just goes on and on.
All right. Well, in that case, then I will not adjourn your committee. I will adjourn the House Revenue Committee, and have a good day, everybody.